People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Today on the program, mental health in the backcountry. How mountain muskox is helping people find connection after traumatic experiences in remote locations. But first, AI psychosis is making its way into the headlines. We'll hear from a clinical psychiatrist about the potential interplay between chatbots and a person's vulnerability to experiencing delusions. Welcome to People First Radio. Psychiatrist Alexandre Houdon says clinicians are beginning to ask a difficult question. Can generative AI exacerbate or even trigger psychosis in vulnerable people? Houdon is a medical psychiatrist at the Institut Universitaire en Santé Mentale de Montréal and an adjunct professor at the Université de Montréal. He broached the phenomenon some have termed AI psychosis in an article in The Conversation and in one published in the academic journal JMIR Mental Health. On today's program, we'll hear from Houdon about what the concerns are and what AI psychosis means.
I'm Dr. Alexandre Houdon. I'm a medical psychiatrist at the Institute of Mental Health in Montreal. I'm also a professor adjunct at the University of Montreal. And I'm conducting a lot of research involving AI and mental health.
And I am very grateful to you for making some time today to talk about AI psychosis. But before we do that, I'm hoping that you could help explain to me just what exactly is psychosis and what does it look like if we put aside the AI part for now?
So psychosis it's a state where a person will lose contact with shared reality. So if we put that in simple terms, it's when the brain has difficulty to distinguish between what comes from inside, so what is pertaining to my thoughts, my beliefs, my interpretation of the world around me, and what actually comes from the outside world. So when we talk about psychosis in mental health terms, usually we're going to have different signals or signs such as delusions. Delusions, they are fixed beliefs that are not shared by other people. For example, I'm being monitored by the government. This has a special meaning for me. But even with factual information, this will be unmovable. Nobody is going to be able to make me change my mind. We also look at hallucinations. So sometimes people can say I'm hearing voices or seeing things that others do not. We can also see in psychosis states disorganized thinking. So when an idea becomes really hard to follow or disconnected, or if, for example, I'm talking to you and I'm jumping from one subject to another to the point you're like, oh, Dr. Houdon, what is he saying? It's difficult. I'm not so sure what he's talking about right now. And there's that question of loss of insight. So the person himself or herself may not be able to realize entirely that something is going wrong. So it can be temporary or chronic. So when we see a psychosis state that is temporary, sometimes it's mostly psychosis episodes that are induced. So for example, with substance abuse or under extreme stress or sleep deprivation, because we're often under the idea that no, only people that are really, really sick experience psychosis, but experiencing hallucinations can be up to 15% of the population. So if you put someone under a certain load of stress or sleep deprivation, they will start experiencing psychosis states. And chronic conditions, they involve mostly severe mood disorders or psychotic disorders such as schizophrenia or other types of psychosis disorder.
What do you think it's important for people who maybe they don't have a close contact kind of experience with psychosis, either themselves or in their family or anything? What do you think it's important for folks in that situation to know about psychosis? What are maybe some misconceptions out there?
I think it's really important for people to understand that psychosis itself It's not a personality flaw or a lack of intelligence or a problem with cognition and things like that. It is really a brain-mind state that can affect anyone under certain conditions. And specific conditions, it's mostly a stress-related state. So people, they have vulnerability, a genetic vulnerability to experience psychosis. But the thing is that we don't know, like, I don't know what's, am I vulnerable or not until we experience psychosis. But what we know is that if you put someone with like a certain number of stressors, they're gonna at some point experience psychosis if I don't remove these stressors. So I want them to understand that this state can be resolved because even if it's chronic or if it's induced or something that's very acute, there are ways to resolve a psychosis state. There are certain triggers. We need to identify these triggers and we need to give the appropriate treatments. And the treatment can involve several things. So, in terms of chronic conditions, it can involve medication. In terms of more acute stressors, such as what we see in substance-induced psychosis and things like that, we're going to do some psychotherapeutic approaches that target substance use disorders and things like that. So it's really person-dependent. We have to really personalize the treatment and the approach depending on the person we have in front of us. But keep in mind that it has nothing to do with you, yourself, your identity, your intelligence. Intelligence, it's really something that's biological.
You've mentioned that psychosis can come with delusions or hallucinations. Are there any commonalities between the delusions that accompany psychosis, that can accompany psychosis? What do we know about where those come from and what causes them?
We know that in most psychotic episodes, the type of hallucinations that people will experience are auditory hallucinations. So they can also experience other types, such as visual, even smelling things that are, there's no associated smells and things like that. And it's mostly done because the brain interprets in a weird way certain signals of the external world or interprets signals that are not there. So, say I'm hearing a voice, but there's nobody talking to me. Well, it could be just because the part of my brain that's supposed to say, hey, I'm picking up a signal, can you interpret the signal, is sending information to the brain even without this signal, which is something we see when people are experiencing psychosis. And in terms of delusions, it can be very, it can vary from one person to another. But one topic is the type of delusions that we call persecutory delusions. So thinking that people are against us, people are plotting against us, people are coming up to get us in some way to attack us, people are spying on us. These are the types of delusions that we see more often. But again, it can be very, very different from one person to another. So for a certain person, it could be thinking that I'm sure that this person is in love with me, which is what we call erotomaniac delusions. People can have a sense of grandiosity, like being convinced that they are multi-billionaires and things like that, when it's not the case. It's called megalomaniac delusions. So there's all sort of delusions that can occur, but persecutory delusions are the most common.
Now, how is AI entering into this conversation? If we were to say the word AI psychosis, what do we mean?
So it's really interesting because this popped up in the media, this word AI psychosis and things like that, but it's not a formal diagnosis. It's really more of a clinical or descriptive term that is being used to describe situations where interaction with AI systems appears to trigger, worsen, or even shape psychotic symptoms in vulnerable individuals. So, in these cases that we call AI psychosis, the AI itself does not really create psychosis out of nowhere, but it does amplify existing vulnerabilities or reinforce certain delusional beliefs or blur reality boundaries and things like that. I'll give you an example. I know there's one case that has been reported in the media where there was that guy that was convinced that his mother was attempting to poison him. So he went and interacted with one of the generative AI available online and said, "I'm convinced my mother is trying to kill me with poison." And the AI was like, "Oh, but this is very improbable. Why would this happen?" and things like that. And the person said, "What would be the different things you would look for if that was the case?" So the AI responded with a set of things to think about to ensure if someone or not is trying to poison me. And it just happened that the AI hit some certain triggers, the sense that if your mother is switching the type of food she's preparing you, if the time at which she serves the food are not the same as the usual time. And apparently this was the case. So it reinforced the delusional belief that this person, well, his mother was poisoning him. So unfortunately, the story that appeared in the media, this person killed his mother and killed himself after. So when I say reinforce delusional beliefs, it can be really intense. And this is why we say AI psychosis, because without this implication of AI in this story, well, perhaps this would not have happened. But we don't have any crystal balls, so it's difficult to state if that would have been the case or not.
You're listening to People First Radio. My guest is Alexandre Houdon. He's a medical psychiatrist at the Institut Universitaire en Santé Mentale de Montréal and an adjunct professor at the Université de Montréal. We're talking about the potential interactions between generative AI and psychosis on today's program. In August of last year, Microsoft AI CEO Mustafa Suleiman shared in a thread on X, formerly Twitter, that reports of delusions, AI psychosis, and unhealthy attachment keep rising. In that thread, he also wrote that companies shouldn't claim or promote the idea that their AIs are conscious, and that the AIs themselves shouldn't promote it either. The idea that it can lead to problems if we anthropomorphize generative AI is something Dr. Houdon touched on in our conversation as well.
It's really early so far to state what is the causality between the use of AI and the actual delusions that were being reinforced and things like that. We know from the different stories that appeared on the media and some clinical reports that are starting to be published in the literature. We can start to identify which individuals are most at risk when they interact with AI. And this way, we understand that AI, like especially the chatbot agents available and things like that, it's when they play this role of being a confidant or a therapist or something like that, when we start to anthropomorphize, give humane characteristics to that AI, that things start to be problematic. Because it's not AI itself that is the problem, it's more the interaction between the AI. So it's the process which is the problem. So in individuals that are at risk with psychotic disorders or people that already are diagnosed with schizophrenia, bipolar disorders, or that have a history of psychosis. So let's say that that guy who smoked pot once and did a psychotic episode, well, we know that he's vulnerable for psychosis. So we know that this person could be vulnerable when chatting with AI by reinforcing certain beliefs or certain information that could be problematic. And we know that people that experience trauma in the past or dissociative episode where they feel that they were not there at the present time, or they're out of their body, or they're walking on clouds, that's what we call dissociations. And we know that people that are under extreme stress for various conditions could be due to their relationship, their work, their family condition, things like that, or experience social isolation, substance use problem, or sleep deprivation, are more prone to experience reinforcements of delusions when interacting with AI.
Are some of the concerns that are maybe showing up in wider media reports around this idea of AI psychosis, are those things that you are encountering in your practice?
Well, it's tricky because it's not something we actually screen for at the moment. I do try to screen this now because I'm conducting research in that field. But when you do your psych training or any other professional in the field of mental health, There's very little information made available about how to screen what we call cyber habits, like computer use, using video games, using the internet, like what do we consider a problematic use versus what is a sane use of that. So now I start screening regularly my patients with their usage with Gen AI. And the difficulty I experience right now is that, for example, I have some patients telling me, well, you're treating me for that condition using this molecule, but ChatGPT or any other AI source said that I should use this instead for that period of time. And then you try to explain them what's behind your choice of molecule or why you took a certain treatment plan. And they argue with you with the arguments provided by AI. But the thing we have to keep in mind is that the AI, when it's interacting with a user, it's making a mathematical profile of that user. Because AI, it's not the human, it's really just a set of mathematics, logic, equations that attempts to give you content that's going to please you. So it only gets a picture of who you are from the information you give it. So the AI is not aware of the entire context of the person. So when it's attempting to personalize interactions and things like that, it's really more often a mirror effect of what the user wants or wants to hear. So now you're trying to explain a treatment plan to a user that's being reinforced by an AI conversation and things like that. And that creates really a really more difficult conversation as compared to when people were using Google or were conducting their own research and came up with a scientific paper or a media article or things like that. Said, is that good? Is that bad? Should I use this? Should I use that? Now we have some form of artificial intelligence providing counter arguments that have really little to do with the clinical realities of the person because the AI itself is not aware of what's going on. So that's the sort of things we start seeing right now. I started to do a literature review of all the cases where AI was related or linked to suicide attempts or completed suicide and psychosis-like adverse events. Now, so far, we retrieved about 60 cases in North America, and we're attempting to publish that in the next few months. And we're trying to identify profiles of these users to understand more what caused that link between the adverse event and the AI use. So that's what's coming up, but it's still a very new phenomenon that we're trying to study and try to establish treatment plans.
It seems like we're in this period where there are a lot of news reports that are coming out around different concerns with aspects of AI and people's mental well-being. They could be things like potential negative consequences of people forming quasi-romantic relationships with AI chatbots, or people perhaps uncritically depending on AI for sort of serious mental health support. How do potential concerns about what we're talking about, AI psychosis, how do they fit into that wider picture? What do you think it's important people know about them?
I think it's really important for people to understand that even though AI is available 24/7 and looks like it's understanding you, it's not a typical relationship in the sense that the alliance that you build, the relationship you build with AI, it's based on very different logical assumptions as compared to what is usually seen between two human beings or a group of people. So you have to keep in mind that AI can be good for something. My goal is not to demonize AI and say AI is bad. AI is a really good tool. So when you're trying to do simple tasks, look up for information, understand where this information looks from, redirect you to a source and literature and things like that, this is very good. But when we were trying to do abstract stuff and you talked about relationships and things like that, these are very complex human bonds, human behaviors, really abstract. AI is really bad actually in doing that. But we tend to forget this because when we're up to something such as a chatbot reflecting us that when we're experiencing an argument or conflict, that, oh, we're right because of this. Oh, you should behave that way because that's going to work in that situation. You're such a genius to have thought about this and things like that. For people that are in a vulnerable spot, that have self-esteem issues, that are isolated and things like that, it can be a positive reinforcer that can be problematic because, as I said, there's no thinking going into this. It's just a set of logic operations that try to please you, that give you back this content, but it's not backed by anything. So if things go wrong while using AI, nobody's responsible, and putting this in quotes, in the sense that the AI was designed in a certain way, the interaction went that way. So most of the time, these are very opaque algorithms. We don't know too much what's going into them and why it reached out to that conclusion. But it's really you interacting with a set of mathematical operation. Whereas if you experience mental health issues and you go to a therapist, this person has been licensed. This person knows that there are some benefits to conduct psychotherapy, but there are also risks. So just doing a basic psychotherapy has its sets of risks, and the therapist is aware of these risks. And someone could argue, well, there's good therapists, there's bad therapists. Yeah, but they are, they have to report to their order of therapists depending on where you are and things like that. They have a set of rules to follow. They can be subject to lawsuits and things like that. Whereas when you talk with a chatbot, an AI chatbot, it's very vague what the set of rules are, what you're actually getting your information from. And this is to be taken in with great concern. So if you think of it as a tool and not as a relationship with an actual human, this is already a big step. And this is going to protect you from potential negative interactions.
So again, to make sure I understand what some of the concerns are, or some of the ways this could look, some of the concerns might be that an AI chatbot could have a little bit of a tendency to be a sort of yes man. It's kind of easier to get it to find some pieces of evidence somewhere to support whatever you're trying to get it to go along with, as opposed to maybe a normal human in those circumstances might be more apt to challenge you. That's one of the concerns.
That's one of the big concerns, in the sense that usually in a normal conversation with another human being, at some point there's going to be a certain level of confrontation or emotional reaction to what you're saying, whether it's positive or negative. It's not always going to be really in sync with what you're saying. Whereas with AI, rapidly it becomes in sync all the times with what you're saying, because it's trying to please you. Trying to understand who you are as a mathematical model, and try to play some set of specific scenarios or display you information in the way that the mathematics behind the algorithm felt, and I say felt in quote here again because it doesn't feel anything, but felt it would be the right way of responding to you specifically from the information you gave it. And this is where it's problematic, because if we reinforce a delusion or a problematic belief without this word of caution that things can go wrong, and that usually in a therapeutic interaction we wouldn't have reinforced necessarily this belief, well, people can start doing things they usually would not do because they have been convinced by the AI.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh, and I'm speaking with Dr. Alexandre Houdon, a medical psychiatrist and adjunct professor in Montreal. We're speaking about generative AI and psychosis. So again, complete hypothetical. I have no real insight on this, but is a situation someone could say to an AI chatbot something like, I think I am being watched by whatever, and the AI chatbot might at first say that seems really unlikely. But then a person could offer, well, all of these devices have cameras, maybe someone could use them to watch me, and the AI chatbot might push back a little more, or it might eventually start to say, well, yeah, I mean, maybe. And then kind of tip over the scales of reinforcing the delusion? Is that sort of this idea of AI psychosis that is more or less an example of the
That's a
concern?
great example. And we have to keep in mind that when it first came out, available to the public in 2022, until now, the algorithms changed and things like that. Guardrails have been made in place to prevent certain types of situations. So, for instance, you go in pretty much any chatbot these days and you say, I'm considering suicide. Immediately, it's going to give you suicide hotlines and resources and things like this. But still, it's not fail-proof. And for individuals that could be susceptible to, as I said, delusions or psychotic vulnerabilities, the interactions you make with AI, at some point, the AI is going to give in and try to please you. So if you try to convince AI with external world information, as you said, if you say this device has a lot of cameras, well, the AI is going to use this in its response to you. And at some point, it's going to say that what you're saying or what you're thinking is probable and give you specific examples from your life, even if in the real world, a therapist or someone else would have said, no, no, that's really unlikely. That element of conscience, it's not there with AI. So we have to keep this in mind.
And then you've suggested that maybe a person in your practice, you will be working with someone and they might have some delusions and you'll push back a little bit and they'll say, but the AI, it was kind of on my side on this and that makes it a little more difficult for you. That's another piece of this.
Yeah, definitely. It's more difficult. And we have to keep in mind that as a psychiatrist, when I try to challenge certain beliefs, I always come back to the models we have of our understanding of how the human being thinks, how human being thinks. And we know that every thought is linked to an emotion and a behavior. And that's the thing. If you use AI and it's giving you ideas and things like that, that's going to make you change your line of thoughts. This is going to come with emotions and behaviors that were made this way. So when I do this activity of challenging a thought with a patient in a specific encounter, a medical encounter and things like this, I know what I have in mind. I know where I want to go with that specific challenge because it's going to be therapeutic in some way with regards to what the person is experiencing. But the AI cannot do this. The AI is going to try to reinforce your idea with what you're providing it. So this is where in my practice it's difficult because when the AI is trying to convince the person in front of you that they are right, and it happens in certain cases. I mean, patients, they have questions. They have their own experience of the mental disorder or the physical disorder they're experiencing, and they challenge us, and at some point they are right. But again, this is a human conversation. So if someone challenges me and it goes back to, oh yeah, I didn't think about that when I initiated this treatment, I'll try to change my ways. But when it comes from an AI, it doesn't come from an experiential set of situation in the day-to-day basis. It doesn't come from a specific source from the literature. It comes from a vague data set that we don't know where it comes from, in the sense that certain AI, they use the entire web as their data set. Other AI, they use a very specific set of rules that filters their data set and things like that. So most of the information comes from a very opaque world that nobody knows where it's coming from. And it's structured their argument with what the user is providing it. So it's very, when the word artificial is very good when we say artificial intelligence, because that's the whole point. It's not an actual relationship. It's not an intelligence. It's not a relation that is being constructed with two human conscience. It's really just, I'm interacting with a machine and the mathematical equations are providing me with an answer that's most probable to please me.
Where do you think this is all going? What are the parts of this you think or you want research to answer, and what are maybe some of the things you think are the necessary safeguards?
Well, I think the different governments, they have to act quickly and establish a basic set of rules of how to better use AI and how to make sure the general population knows the different dangers when using AI. So how to better use AI? Because I don't think it would be a good idea to just banish AI and say you can't use it. It's already part of our daily lives. So it's how to better use AI, how to be more aware of the different problems that can and things that can go wrong with AI. And I think in terms of research, one really important part is that, well, people who experience psychotic-like symptoms while using AI or conducted suicide attempts or had mood disorders and things like this, following their use of AI, what can we do for them? Like, what should be the treatment plan? At this point, there's nothing evidence-based to help these people. And I think it's our role as medical professionals to research how we can better help these people because these are going to come more often. We start seeing them in the news outlets, the medias, and things like that. But we're starting to see them in our emergencies, in our daily appointments with patients, and things like that. So we need to have a set of tools to help these people experiencing difficult issues or adverse events while using AI. So on my side, I know we have already projects going on to try and assess that, especially on the psychotherapeutic side, less on the well, more psychology side, and less on the medication side as of now. But I think we need to keep an eye on this phenomenon because it's going to be more and more prevalent in the next few years.
And this is something that's more related to maybe the concept of psychosis in general. But certainly, I think it's fair to say that most times the subject of psychosis appears in the news media and has the widest audience, it's when something really bad has happened. And in our conversation already, you've suggested probably 15% of people at any given time could be susceptible to experiencing psychosis. I don't know. What do you think it's important to make sure to say in a conversation like this one where there's a little more time and breadth about just sort of media literacy and psychosis, be it AI or not?
There's that wow factor with the word psychosis. You have to keep in mind that most people, especially those with chronic psychosis, psychotic conditions such as schizophrenia and things like this, they're more prone to intimidation and self-directed violence than being violent themselves or engaging in a very damaging behaviors towards other. So we have to keep in mind that this sensationalism is maybe a misuse of the word psychosis because what we're really seeing in the media when we talk about AI psychosis and things like that, it's really more delusions experienced by chatting with conversational chatbot and things like that. It's not really that you became psychotic because you used any sort of Gen AI and things like that. It's more like you were vulnerable to experience psychotic-like symptoms, and your usage of that was the extra stressor you needed to make you enter a psychotic state. One image I have in mind is if we, when I talked about the vulnerabilities, I see that more of a recipient in the sense that we have a recipient that can accommodate a certain load of stress. And if we think of stress as maybe water we add in that recipient, we don't know how big our recipient is, but at some point it's going to overflow. And that's the thing. Some people, they have very big recipients. Some people, it's really small. But when people use Gen AI for any sort of trying to maybe understand more their situation and things like that, it could become that one drop of water that makes the recipient overflow. So this is more what we think of it being AI psychosis. So it's really not, it's not a new diagnostic, it's not a new clinical entity. It's more like an explanation of that specific trigger that made so that the person, when we take the whole picture, entered a psychotic state or reinforced a delusional belief.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation today about AI psychosis or anything related to it?
I think it's really important for people to be aware that AI is not just that sort of magic or super intelligence that can solve your everyday problem, even if it's often portrayed this way. It's really to use it as a tool for a specific goal that you have in mind and to always challenge the information that AI gives you. I know it's something that's not what we usually do on a daily basis when we're exposed to the media or the TV and things like that. But with AI, it's especially important to challenge the information that's being given back to us because considering the algorithms are very, very opaque, the quality of the information will always seem good, but is it really? You have to ask yourself this question. And if you keep being critical and you use it as a tool and not a therapist and not a life companion and things like that, you're going to minimize the risks by a lot. So that's the thing you have to keep in mind.
Alexandre Houdon, thank you very much for making the time to speak with me.
Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciated it.
Dr. Alexandre Houdon is a medical psychiatrist at the University Institute of Mental Health in Montreal and an adjunct professor at the University of Montreal.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
The muskox is an animal known for coming together in a circle to protect calves from danger. That behavior inspired mountain muskox, an organization with a number of chapters in BC and Alberta that seeks to bring together community to support and care for those who have been impacted by loss or trauma in the mountains. Like muskoxen in the wild, mountain muskox groups come together in circles where mountain community members join with professional facilitators to create a support network. Lexi Morgan is one of the professional facilitators involved in the Sea to Sky chapter of Mountain Muskox. I spoke with her about the group and about mental health in the backcountry.
My name is Lexi Morgan. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm a registered clinical counselor based in Vancouver, BC. And I do lots of work here in Vancouver with individuals through my private counseling practice, Monteira Mental Health, where I see adults in person as well as virtually across the province, focusing on an array of issues and challenges ranging from relationship dynamics, life and career direction. I work a lot with students. My office is really close to the UBC campus. But on top of all of that, I would say I have this kind of section of my work that really focuses on workplace mental health and mental health like literacy for the tourism and ski industry, as well as like adventure-based work environments, kind of more rural and remote areas. And then I do a lot of work up and down the Sea to Sky region, as well as in the interior, working with organizations like Helicat Canada, the Association of Canadian Mountain Guides, various heli ski operators. And then a big part of my work is also with an organization called Mountain Muskox, which I think we'll talk a little bit more about. And this all is sort of connected to kind of my own lived experience of living and working in mountain communities, managing heli ski lodges as well as remote lodges, and just having a real passion for working with folks kind of in that space. Yeah, I can speak more to that, but that's a little bit of an overview of kind of who I am, what my work is, and where I work and how I do it.
And we're going to be talking about mental health in the backcountry, mountain muskox. What is the story behind that organization? What does it do?
Yeah, so Mountain Muskox is a relatively new organization. It was founded, I believe, in 2021 by a group of folks in the Bow Valley, kind of Canmore Banff area in Alberta. Was sort of the brainchild of a group of individuals, both professional athletes, as well as recreationalists and mental health professionals, who really recognized this of isolate, social isolation that comes after someone might experience a traumatic event, a near miss, an injury or loss in the outdoors. And it was really formulated to try and turn folks towards each other in a space of healing and shared understanding, recognizing that, especially in mountain communities, but not specifically to mountain communities, but in those spaces, when someone had experienced a traumatic event, a near miss, a loss, when that's the place that you maybe work, like the mountains can be a place that you work or recreate, spend time, socialize, find peace and grounding when it's challenging to get back out there and to spend time with others because of what's happened to you, there can just be an immense amount of loneliness can impact your mental health. So the idea was really to just get folks together so that they could talk about what their experiences were like, understand and make sense of what had happened. There was no emphasis on like returning folks to their sport or to their work, but more just kind of understanding that trauma, healing, mental health, all the associated aspects of that can really look different for everyone, and then also have sort of through lines of similarity. So the idea was fairly simple. It was just bring people together, have it professionally facilitated by counselors and mental health professionals so that, you know, kind of understanding the like sensitive nature of a topic like trauma, really wanting to make sure there was some containment around that work, and spend time together. And so that, you know, that happened, I believe they kind of did a one-off circle, and then it was kind of like, whoa, this is pretty powerful and important. I wonder if we could kind of more clearly structure this, and then how do we sort of expand this into other mountain communities? So that was kind of the origin of Muskox. And then I'm happy to talk more about what it's kind of now evolved into, but that was the beginning.
What do you think are the parts of this that someone who hasn't necessarily spent a significant amount of time in the backcountry might have a harder time relating with or getting or understanding?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I think that we talk a lot. My colleague who I co-facilitate some of these circles with, she describes it really beautifully of like when there is an accident, near miss, traumatic event in the backcountry or in the outdoors, you know, for the individual, there can be this kind of tear, this rupture that happens between the individual and the land, between the individual and their community, if they're with other people, and then a tear between the individual with themselves, because sometimes it can feel like, what did I do? What were my sort of, you know, what was my responsibility, decision-making, sense of self and identity can really be impacted. And I think that if you haven't spent time living, working, recreating in the backcountry in the mountains, it can be difficult to maybe understand kind of why it would be so devastating to not have access to those spaces anymore, to feel like maybe why it was so difficult to not feel like you could go for a hike or go ski touring or go rock climbing again. If you haven't really been sort of embedded in those spaces, it can be a type of loss that can feel hard to capture for maybe the average person who hasn't spent time in those places. So there's a lot of kind of uniqueness there. And I think for a lot of folks who have something happen in the backcountry, you know, goes from being this like very sort of sacred, wonderful, magical, joy-filled space where they get a lot of like peace and grounding and exercise and social connection. You know, it can be a place that goes from being really, really beneficial to a place that can feel scary and not what it used to be. And that shift, that tear is really hard. It also really, yeah, the identity piece, the community piece, that maybe is where they socialize. So yeah, I think that's what we're sort of seeing with folks coming to Muskox, is they're looking for that kind of connection and understanding of that experience, which is really unique.
Which brings us to the circles that happen at Mountain Muskox. Could you tell me a little bit about what those are like?
Absolutely. So The concept of the circle, and I should also sort of go back to actually the name of the organization, Mountain Muskox. So the muskoxen is a type of animal that when one of them are injured, the rest of the muskoxen circle around them to protect the injured muskox. So the concept of muskox is to kind of bring folks into this idea of a circle, the concept of, healing and protecting, recognizing when somebody is, injured, either physically or emotionally, that we're there as, kind of this group. So, circles typically happen once a month. We have circles in the Bow Valley, in Golden, in the Kootenays, in Squamish, and we're running a pilot circle in Whistler. And they are professionally facilitated by counselors, as I mentioned, and they're typically about 3 hours long, which can sound a bit long at first. But the reasoning for why they're long or why that length of time is because we do a lot of work to kind of call it like build the container effectively. Like when someone arrives at a circle, I would say circles really range in size. They can be, from maybe like 7, 8 folks, plus usually two facilitators, up to about maybe 14 individuals, but we try and keep them around that size. The sort of building of the container, as I was mentioning, is the facilitators really working to make sure that folks kind of know what to expect. There's introductions, there's grounding, there's kind of parameters and rules that we go through each session to make sure that people kind of understand what they can expect from the circle. So what you would find if you attended a circle, at least in the Sea to Sky in Squamish, where I facilitate, and in Whistler, is a group of individuals sitting around in a space. We would do a short check-in where folks would introduce themselves. We do a color rating system. So, like, are you arriving at circle today feeling green, yellow, or red? Green feeling really resourced, yellow feeling a little in the middle, or red feeling like lower energy. That helps us kind of understand what the energy of the circle is. Folks would, introduce themselves. Myself and the co-facilitator would kind of go through these parameters. We don't have folks explicitly share details about their trauma, traumatic events. It's not group therapy. It's really a peer-to-peer support model. There's an element of confidentiality that happens. So we make an agreement that, what's shared in circle isn't to be sort of shared more broadly. And then there's also kind of this agreement that we're going to always speak from I, like, what I have found helpful for me is blank, and not do a lot of advice giving. And then typically myself and the co-facilitator will have come up with a theme or a topic for the circle. Usually there's an element of kind of bigger group sharing or breakout groups, smaller groups kind of centered around that topic. And then we usually have a bit of a break and we come back and we do what we would call like psychoeducation. So this would be like a tool that myself or the co-facilitator would kind of share with the group. We would go through it. They might, have some dialogue around it. The tool is often to do with kind of like coping, regulating, making sense and understanding kind of how our bodies and nervous systems react to trauma, different, models around grief. So the topic and the psychoeducation are a piece of wanting to make sure that folks feel like they're kind of learning and making sense of what happened to them, even though we can't always make sense of it because sometimes these things don't make sense. And then there's a checkout. There's this opportunity to kind of say how you're doing leaving the space, and sort of do that kind of color-coded system again to be like, where am I at leaving, right? And sometimes people leave a little bit more depleted because it's been a big, evening of sharing, and other times people leave feeling a little bit lighter. And so, we're really there to kind of hold any type of emotion or response or experience. So it's a long-winded answer, but that's kind of an overview of what you can expect from a circle and kind of the premise of it. It's the idea of being in circle together is a way of co-regulating, right? It's a way of anchoring to other nervous systems, of sort of turning towards one another. And in that sort of spirit of the muskoxen, that sort of idea of community as being a resource.
You're listening to People First Radio. My guest is Lexi Morgan. She's a registered clinical counselor based in Vancouver. She's involved with the organization Mountain Muskox. It's a community to support and care for those who have been impacted by loss or trauma in the mountains. She is involved with the Sea to Sky chapter of Mountain Muskox, which meets in Squamish. What have you seen the circles be able to do for people? What have some of the results been for folks who have come in?
Yeah, so, you know, I think anecdotally, I've watched folks who have arrived at Circle pretty soon after an accident or a traumatic event and come really consistently to Circle and find an immense amount of support and care through the range of emotions and challenges that come through the anger, the upset, the confusion, the grief. And Muskox is a place where you can show up and be any version of yourself. We don't need you to have all the answers to know what you need necessarily. But, you know, I think that we call it the third M, Mountain Muskox mentorship. So mentorship is a key component of our work. And, you know, having folks, it's a really unique system, right? So it's not a closed group. Anybody can register at any time. So we have folks who have been coming consistently to Circles for years. We have folks who've been coming, you know, for a couple of months. And often you're seeing the folks who are really at a maybe a different place in their healing, in their self-work, being able to offer support to the folks who are very kind of newly going through this. And actually at our most recent Circle, I just was able to witness this so beautifully. We had quite a few newer folks pretty recently, fresh out of some events and accidents, with some folks who are, you know, months, if not years, kind of into that process. And to see the gentleness, the compassion, the hope holding that happens with our group is pretty transformative. I don't know a lot of spaces like this and a lot of groups that are modeled like this. A lot of times you're going to see groups that are kind of closed, meaning it's the same group of people week after week or month after month. But because of that kind of open door evolution of involvement, you get to see the kind of trajectory of healing. It's a place where people report feeling really understood, really the only place where they feel like they can talk openly, the only place where they feel like they have any sense of hope of feeling better or feeling differently. I think it complements really nicely with kind of maybe one-on-one therapy or sort of healing processes, because it is that community kind of co-regulation and support. So yeah, I would say I've seen lots of amazing things happen in Circle.
If we're zooming out of that and we're talking about just mental health on a level of anyone in any place in any time, are there any, I don't know, important nuggets you think you could share that are broadly applicable that come out of the experience of Mountain Muskox?
Yeah, you know, I think that there is something so impactful and powerful about not feeling alone in your experience. And to hear participants say over and over again something to the effect of, wow, I didn't think anybody understood this, or I felt worried that I was the only one that felt this way, or I never thought I would feel differently about what had happened. And, you know, I think what Muskox is doing and achieving in this really sort of specific space of mountain communities, I think translates more broadly to this idea of like isolation and aloneness in mental health and trauma. I think we could see a lot more come from being able to connect folks to one another that, you know, especially if you've had a similar experience, whatever it may be. I've had done some work in grief and loss and hospice organizations, and, you know, seeing folks brought together in kind of, you know, group spaces, that often is the sentiment. And I think that, we tend to be a pretty individualist culture, maybe more broadly speaking, and trying to find ways to connect folks to one another, however that might be, is really important. And I think MaskOx does that in a way that's free, it's accessible, it's confidential, it's professionally facilitated, but it's also sort of specialized to this one group. There's a lot going on there that I think really makes it what it is. And this sort of emphasis around, like, let us help you turn towards other people, so that you might not feel so alone in your experience.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation today on this?
I mean, I think as it pertains to MaskOx, if you or anyone you think might benefit from being a part of this programming, please don't hesitate to reach out. I think that it can maybe feel intimidating at first, the length of time, the kind of like concept of sitting with other people. You don't have to have experienced a traumatic event or near miss or loss recently. We've had folks who come, 4 or 5 years after something's happened because they feel called to be kind of in the space with other people. If you have any questions about if it's something that would work for you or somebody you can always reach out and we will help you kind of decision make through that. And it's an amazing opportunity to connect to other people who really understand it.
Alexi Morgan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Lexi Morgan is a registered clinical counselor based in Vancouver. She's involved with the Sea to Sky chapter of a group called Mountain Muskox, which meets in Squamish. The organization is a community to support and care for those who have been impacted by loss or trauma in the mountains. That's it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.